Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whom I have been enormously impressed with for his acumen and his understanding, really, of the character of that free world and the threats to it is our first guest. He is Benjamin Weingarten, and at a remarkably tender age, he has, seems to me, gotten pretty squared away and helping the rest of us do the same through such outlets as the London Center for Policy Research, where he is a senior fellow, also outlets like The Federalist and National Review and Newsmax. He is also the founder and CEO of ChangeUp Media, LLC, a media consulting firm, and perhaps to his particular credit, a Publius Fellow of the Claremont Institute. I'm insanely jealous for that distinction. Benjamin Weingarten, welcome back. It's so good to have you, I think, for the first time in our new year, so a happy one to you.
Yes, Frank, happy new year to you as well, and thank you, as always, for that very kind introduction.
Well, I'm thinking it's more than deserved, and want you to demonstrate it by your thoughtful comments. Let's talk a little bit about the State of the Union. Ben, I was so struck, as I think an awful lot of Americans were, I'm told even 70 or so percent of CNN viewers, if you can believe it, by the performance of the president, the extent to which he made a profound, well, I call it love letter to America as his principal message, and the contrast between that and the seeming indifference, if not outright hostility, of Democrats to those themes of loving our country and its principles and symbols and accomplishments. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think there are, as you put it properly, a contrast that is incredibly striking. And to me, there are two images that will always resonate from this State of the Union. On the one hand, you have a North Korean defector who fought his way to freedom, standing valiantly, holding up his crutches, celebrating freedom, and the entire gallery in raucous applause. And on the other hand, the other image is that of Democrats sitting on their hands, holding their applause, and in some cases howling and booing the core tenets of what make America, America. There were remarkable images of when the president was discussing lower unemployment rates or the costs borne by American citizens of illegal immigration or the dramatic acceleration of economic growth in the face of the president's deregulatory agenda. All of those things down to basic core items like celebrating faith, family, the individual over the state, in God we trust, the Democrats sat on their hands. And I think that is a very perfect illustration of where the left is today. And incidentally, I think an interesting proxy for what we might see in a midterm elections, which many conservatives have been highly concerned about, and rightfully so, I think, based upon the seats that are up and the way the map is drawn. But if you look at the Democrats sitting for almost everything the president said during that speech in disgust, and then you see a poll which shows overwhelming majorities, and in particular, including independents, who were in favor of what the president was arguing, I think there's a real interesting contrast there, and maybe these midterm elections won't be as dire as they tend to be during the first midterm in a president's first term.
Yeah, you know, Ben, I think that's so right. Your thinking on the State of the Union tracks perfectly with mine, which proves your acumen as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, I was talking with colleagues yesterday, and I think there's a general view that there's an opportunity for a real tipping point here, with the chance not only to expose what is the hostility, as you say, of the Democrats to these core principles that so many of us embrace. As the president put it, you know, we're all dreamers. In the end, American dream. And this is really something that they were flouting so dramatically. I think it gave real offense. Now, of course, it will depend on, you know, the messaging and what happens in between times. But I do think that especially if what is actually the background and the political associations as well as tendencies of those who are taking these stridently, anti-American views, it may well prove to be a very different kind of election than we were expecting. But let me turn to one other thing that you've written about recently, Ben Weingarten, at the Federalist, I believe. You talked about the president's national security strategy, which overall I thought was a pretty impressive document. The concern I've had has been partly the implementation of it, much as we saw a failure to implement some of his key, you know, policy prescriptions enunciated during the campaign during his first year. Talk about the myths that you think the strategy exposes and the likelihood that we'll actually see the strategy faithfully implemented now.
Well, first, I agree with you. The national security strategy, which defines itself as defining a president's strategy of principled realism, is a very eloquent, robust, comprehensive elucidation of the kind of America first, U.S. national interest focused principles that have to undergird a policy if we're to reverse the sort of liberal, progressive, Wilsonian internationalism that has marked our foreign policy establishment and thus our foreign policy for decades, I would argue, to our great detriment. What I pointed out in this piece were three particular core myths that the NSS, the National Security Strategy, points to. The first one being that economic liberalization leads to political liberalization. The second, that in effect, Israel is the core issue that stands at the heart of all the Middle East's problems. And the third principle that the NSS points out, and one that we've spoken about in the past, is the National Security Strategy arguing that we are not at war with violent extremists who are nihilistic, but rather with the jihadist enemy focused on implementing Sharia law worldwide. Three key principles, any of which I'm happy to go through, but which point at the premises that are flawed within that Wilsonian progressive internationalist foreign policy establishment. And if we can reverse these flawed premises, we can stop with the failed policies and ultimately make a stronger, more secure, more prosperous America.
Yeah, boy, I couldn't agree more. And I think they're really illustrative of the kind of break from the Obama administration's policies, most especially, that the president promised. But I am concerned. I don't think we saw as much progress during the first year as we should have, a notable exception perhaps being the decision to recognize reality and move the embassy to Israel's capital. But on the others, particularly that last bit about the violent extremists, I note the president did not use the term radical Islamic terrorism in the State of the Union address, let alone talk about Sharia as the national security strategy does. So we'll be watching closely for its implementation. Hey, Ben, before we run out of time, very quickly, this may be overtaken by events. There's talk that sometime in the course of the day today, the president may actually cut loose the so-called memorandum of the House Intelligence Committee, make it publicly available rather than, as some are counseling him, interpose objections to it. But by the time this goes to air, we may know the answer. But what are your thoughts on the advisability of releasing the memo?
Well, Sunlit is the best disinfectant, and I think it's very telling that you have this apparently massive campaign to try to stop the divulging of critical information that alleges the most serious types of abuses that threaten the civil rights of all Americans, by the way, not just the people who are the persons of interest with respect to the Russia investigation and all the associated other investigations. I would just say that, of course, the rank and file members of all of these institutions are great Americans. They are patriots. That doesn't mean that there are not abuses, and especially in the places in government where there's the most power. And unfortunately, the power to destroy political opponents is one that it appears the Obama administration may have taken repeatedly. And given my grave concerns and the grave concerns that everyone should have across the aisle, we should all be advocating for the disclosure of as much material as we can possibly get, from the memo down to the underlying information on which it's based, to the degree which it can be released. And the major problem that we're seeing here is that the national security and intelligence agencies involved with this are the ones who are telling us what we can and cannot see, but they're the ones being investigated. And that's why we need Congress to do its oversight powers, and we need the president to assert himself.
Amen. We have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. Ben Weingarten of the London Center for Policy Research, thank you so much for your time today and for the extraordinary work you're doing. We'll get back to you soon because I want to talk to you about whether we'll get to the bottom of the Iran scandals as well. But that's for another day. In the meantime, stay well, my friend. Keep up the good work and come back to us soon. Next up, we'll speak about this memo business and more with our colleague Fred Flights of the Center for Security Policy right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's our privilege to be joined, as we are each week, by one of the greatest of Americans, as far as I'm concerned, my friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, Fred Flights, a career intelligence professional. And by that I mean he has spent some 20 years of his life working as an analyst in the Central Intelligence Agency. He also served as the chief of staff to Ambassador John Bolton when he was the Undersecretary of State. He also has served on the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, often known in Washington circles by its acronym, the HPSI. And as a result, he is especially and perhaps uniquely qualified to help us make sense of what on earth is going on at the moment involving a memo that the majority of the House Intelligence Committee has authorized to be released. As we speak, the decision is with the president. By the time this goes to air, he may have acted, but we're going to probe and explore with Fred Flights the various rationales, justifications, excuses that are being offered up, both by members of the House Intelligence Committee and others for not releasing that memo. But Fred, with all of that, let me just say thank you for joining us and for helpfully walking us through what's going on with this House memo.
Well, Frank, it's good to be here. Well, let's get down to brass tacks. Someone's lying here. Either the FBI is lying that the release of the Republican memo and the Justice Department would cause grave national security damage, or Congressman Nunes is lying that the FBI is simply trying to obstruct. They can't both be true. Now, ordinarily, it's really unheard of to imagine a member of Congress would ignore such an urgent demand and warning by the FBI and the Justice Department. It's extraordinary the Justice Department would, and the FBI would be accused of such political meddling. My view is, look, I've been on the House Intelligence Committee. I've helped staff. I've written staff memos. I've worked with some of the members there, both personally, and I've met some of them since they left. I got to tell you, I can't believe they would say what they've said about the objections by the Justice Department and the FBI that they were not true. And given the meddling during the election to hurt Donald Trump and to look the other way and give excuses for Hillary Clinton for her serious violations of handling classified information, a private email server, I believe lying during the official investigation. The FBI and the Justice Department just aren't credible on this issue. And this is a terrible state of affairs that we have to consider such a possibility. So my view is we've got to get this memo out, and we have to get past the noise being created by careerists in the FBI and the Justice Department. And we have to completely disregard what the Democrats are saying because they have no interest in getting to the truth.
Now, I did want to turn next to what the Democrats are saying, Fred Flights. They're claiming that the committee's majority, and I think you're right to say, you know, this isn't just Congressman Nunes and his particular views on this. This is a view that is shared by all of the Republican members of the committee, which is saying something because there are quite a number of them that would, under other circumstances, I think almost certainly accede to the kinds of complaints that you've just described coming from Justice and the FBI and elsewhere. But in this case, the Democrats are saying, wait a minute, they've cherry-picked the evidence. They've ignored or simply not read some of the underlying documents that they're pointing to as justifying these findings that are in the four pages. They've actually changed the memo since it was approved by the House Intelligence Committee's majority. Can you, first of all, help us understand those rationales for not going forward. And more to the point, Fred, talk about what are the implications of this kind of very clear partisan rift between members of the committee. I don't think it's always been thus. In fact, I think in much of the past it hadn't been. But talk us through all of that, if you would.
Well, as I said, I've helped write memos like this. I've also discussed this with a member of the House Intelligence Committee staff just yesterday. And this is my read on it. Normally, memos like this are written by Republican and Democratic staffers. They try to agree on the main memo, then additional views are added. Sometimes the minority will write a long dissent. But the Democrats were excluded from the drafting of this memo. Why was that? The reason is because they've leaked everything. They've become impossible to work with. It's so bad, the Republicans had to resort to this extraordinary process. They basically, I was told, anything that will hurt Trump, Congressman Schiff will leak. It's happened repeatedly. There's this allegation that the members had not read all the underlying intelligence. There is some truth to that. The reason is that some of this information has only been made available to one member on each side and one staff member on each side. Gowdy was a Republican member who was allowed to read sensitive FISA-related information. What he read and what that staff read has been memorialized in this memo. So this charge that Nunes hasn't read this information, that's because he excluded himself from this investigation at the beginning because of false attacks on him. It's a completely bogus charge. I think this is a memo that reflects a very desperate political situation that the Democrats have created. And what we have here, Frank, is a Democratic Party and members of the House Intelligence Committee. Their sole purpose is destroying the Trump presidency, and they are prepared to use U.S. intelligence. They are prepared to abuse our Justice Department to do so. It is an unbelievable abdication of their responsibility as elected representatives of the people.
Fred, there's so much to what you said there that I'd like to call attention. But one thing that really jumps out at me is in part this kind of partisanship. And the irony, of course, is that the Democrats are claiming this is all a partisan manipulation by the chairman. Another in a long series now of acts of deflection, it seems to me. If there is partisanship, it's the partisanship that was exhibited in the FBI and the Justice Department under the Obama administration. But one other piece of this is it's absolutely predictable, is it not, that you would get this kind of meltdown between Democrats and Republicans, given the kind of people that Nancy Pelosi personally is responsible for selecting as members of the Intelligence Committee. And one that comes to mind, Adam Schiff is a notorious leftist partisan, but a particularly egregious example of this was Andre Carson, a man with extensive ties to the Muslim Brotherhood, for heaven's sakes. And he's on this Intelligence Committee, I believe, for the purpose of undermining its usefulness, if not actually the national security. Your thoughts?
Well, first of all, let's stipulate that both intelligence committees have a long history of breaking down along partisan lines when the country is politically divided. This happened during the Iraq War. I was on the committee then. There were some really ugly scenes in the committee, and I know this also happened in the Senate Intelligence Committee. So this myth in the media that the committee is broken down because of the Republicans, that's just not true. But what you said about the membership of the Democratic side is exactly right. This is a select committee to keep partisans like Schiff and people like Andre Carson, who could pose intelligence problems, off the committee. They're supposed to be hand-chosen by the top Republican and Democrat to put the best possible people on and people who will agree to safeguard classified information. Pelosi has stacked this organization, this committee, with political hacks, her political lieutenants. By contrast, the Republican members have a former CIA officer. They have veterans. They have people who are, I mean, it's just night and day in terms of political hacks and the serious representatives on the Republican side, some of whom have served their country in the military or have served their country as intelligence officers. Those are the kind of people who are supposed to be on this committee. Not this bunch of people who Pelosi put on. Their sole purpose seems to be to run to get on MSNBC and CNN every single day to bash President Trump and to leak classified information.
Fred Flights, thank you for your time as well as for your extraordinary service to our country on the House Intelligence Committee staff. Next up, David Goldman joins us, bringing an economist's eye to assessments of the changes at the Fed and the humiliation of the United States by the Turks in Syria. That and more, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's time for a visit with Spengler, the nom de guerre of David Goldman, a man of truly renaissance intellectual capacity. And I think, fortunately, he puts it to very good use in a number of outlets and publications and joins us from time to time, I'm happy to say, for that purpose. He is the managing director of Reorient Group. You can find his writings, among other places, in, I believe it is, Asia Times. And we're always delighted to catch up with him on the various subjects that are the subject of his focus at the moment, including the departure today of Janet Yellen and what might be her legacy at the Fed. David, welcome back. It's so good to have you with us.
Frank, it's a privilege. Thank you.
So, she is stepping down. The man replacing her seems to be promising not much of a change. But give us sort of an assessment of her record, and in particular, where we find ourselves now as interest rates are beginning to rise. Is that likely to be a continuing practice, or do you think it's not going to impose much more of a burden on our economy than it is at the moment?
The Federal Reserve was pretty clear about what it wanted to do, which is to push people out of safe investments into riskier investments to stimulate economic activity. And they did that by keeping interest rates extremely low for a long period of time. Clearly, they're afraid that if they were to reverse that policy too quickly, then you might have a sharp reversal in markets. There are people like Yellen's predecessor, Alan Greenspan, warning that there are bubbles in the stock and bond market. So I think what the Federal Reserve will do, as it has signaled as clearly as it can, is to act very gradually and very slowly. So there's already an expectation of interest rates rising in the future, which is built into the market. We have priced into the market two additional quarter point increases in the Federal Reserve's overnight rate during the next year. I think we'll probably get another quarter point increase. The really aggressive economic optimists think we might get four instead of two. But what that would translate into, just looking at the graphs, is maybe another 0.3% in treasury yields. The only risk is that if we get a real bout of inflation because labor costs start to shoot up, the Federal Reserve might decide to act a lot more quickly, in which case we could have a real rout in the bond market and some discomfort. Right now, I think we have a modest headwind, and stock prices will chop sideways for a while as they digest it.
Well, let me take advantage of your expertise in all of these matters to ask you about a wild card in the deck, which is, as our friend Kevin Freeman has observed recently, the prospect of significant and perhaps growing capital flight, and that perhaps to some extent the interest rates are going to have to rise on T-bills simply to try to attract further investment at a moment when, as I think you've written, the Japanese seem to be less and less interested in putting money into our treasury notes, but perhaps also the Russians and Chinese as well. What are your thoughts?
I think this is a longer-term concern. Obviously, if the United States keeps running big current account deficits and we keep running big budget deficits, we have to keep borrowing and we have to borrow from foreigners at some point. There will be a dollar crisis, but I don't think we're anywhere near close to it. Right now, I believe that the Chinese are gradually and tentatively trying to develop their RMB as an alternate reserve currency. And we see very symbolic signs of that. For example, the German Central Bank, the European Central Bank, rather, now owns a tiny amount of RMB in its reserve portfolio. But to make a reserve currency work requires many financial engineering, legal, and regulatory changes, which it will take the Chinese years to make. So I think at a 4 or 5 year horizon, that is a serious concern, but I don't think it's a story for 2018. It's simply too difficult to create an alternative to the dollar in the short term.
Dr. Goldman, let me ask you, you heard the Secretary of the Treasury, Steve Mnuchin, talking up, it sounded like, a weaker dollar. Then when he was called on it, he said, oh, no, I didn't mean to do that at all. Is there a dollar crisis in the making in regard to American government policy?
I think Secretary Mnuchin was speaking offhand without taking into account how closely the market would read every syllable of his statement. And I think he walked that back because he never intended to drive the dollar down in the first place. The president also, of course, talked about dollar strength in keeping with a strong U.S. economy. It's certainly the case that the dollar has weakened over the past year. Dollar would buy 1.03 euros about a year ago. Now it's about 1.24. So that's just nearly about a 20% decline. That certainly helped our exports. U.S. export growth has been very strong because the dollar has been cheaper. However, I don't believe that the administration has anything like a worked-out policy to cheapen the dollar further. I think that the press has made too much of these statements. And I don't think they really have thought it out, and they're not on a war path for a cheap dollar.
So if there is a crisis, it won't be of our intentional making. That's the key message here. David, let me turn to one last subject that we won't have time to do justice to because it's complicated and dynamic, unfortunately. But you've written at Asia Times recently about America's Syria humiliation is worse than it looks. That would be a humiliation, I guess, primarily at the moment at the hands of the Iranians, but most especially and most visibly the Turks. What's going on there, and what would you be recommending in terms of policy for the United States at this moment in Syria?
In a nutshell, we decided to create a 30,000-strong border security force, mainly composed of the Kurds, who'd been our allies against ISIS, and had fought very effectively. The Turks have a restive Kurdish population. They were afraid of their country splitting up. They don't like Kurdish power, so they said they wouldn't tolerate it, and they sent their army into Syria. Hasn't done very well, from what I've heard, by the way. The United States politely asked the Turks to stop, and the Turks refused to. That is a very un-ally-like action on the part of the Turks, who thumbed their noses at it. The worst of it is Turkish stocks and the Turkish currency went up all through this, which means bad actors or semi-hostile actors that don't like us, like Qatar, like the Chinese, are financing the Turks. Turkish currency is inherently very weak. The fact that it went up in the midst of a strategic confrontation with the United States is really humiliating. What should we do? Very quietly, we should make sure the Kurds have the wherewithal to hurt the Turks badly and make them want to pull out.
And otherwise, presumably, impress upon them that behaving in this fashion will entail costs with us as well. David, this is a subject to which I look forward to returning with you and others in the days ahead, as I think that the problem with Turkey is growing and is likely to become more strategically fraught, especially as it pulls in the likes of the Iranians and the Chinese and the Russians and the Qataris. We appreciate the work you do in helping sort all of this at the Asia Times, among other places, and look forward to doing so with you again here at Secure Freedom. Thank you for your time today, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, we will speak with Evan Sayet, comedian extraordinaire, about nationalism and socialism, and what happens when the twain meet. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It is a distinct delight to be able to introduce once again to you all Evan Sayet. He is a man I've come to admire greatly, not only for his extraordinary sense of humor, which has made him one of Hollywood's favorite comedians, but also because of his very serious, thoughtful analyses of our times and the challenges, particularly to the freedoms we hold dear. Evan Sayet is the author of an important book on the subject, The Kindergarten of Eden, How the Modern Liberal Thinks. He is also an accomplished comedian, the star of stage and screen, I'm fond of saying, and has over the years provided several very important policy addresses. I think the most recent one of which was last year at the Heritage Foundation, which really rocked the house in the best sense of the word. It's great to have him rock the house with us. Evan Sayet, welcome back and Happy New Year to you. I believe it's our first conversation in the new one.
Right, and that's a shame because it's already February. But yes, Happy New Year, Frank.
And it's more a wish than a prediction also, so there's that too. Evan Sayet, let me ask you about your take on a subject that I think has shocked many Americans, and that is the response of the Democrats in the House of Representatives to the president's State of the Union address, including, you know, his, one would think, absolutely nonpartisan and unobjectionable testaments to the character of our country and its fundamental values and principles and symbols. Even for that matter, the success of efforts to employ Black Americans, all of which were met with indifference, if not hissing and booing and walkouts. Your thoughts?
Yeah, the two sides in the culture war could not have been more obvious and more clear. You know, we've discussed this off the air, but I have a new talk where I point out that after World War II, it was pretty much recognized nothing like National Socialism can ever be allowed to happen again. Nazism, National Socialism. The left took advantage of this and went about convincing the world that the evils of National Socialism was nationalism. Of course, that's not the truth. The evils of National Socialism is socialism. Socialism is a constant, whereas the morality of nationalism depends entirely on the quality of the nation one adores. Of course, if one adores Nazi Germany, then nationalism is a force for evil. But had the Brits not adored Great Britain, they wouldn't have had the strength. They wouldn't have had a reason to stand up to the socialists, Hitler's socialists. If America hadn't believed in American exceptionalism, had we not been patriots, had we not been nationalists, we wouldn't have had the reason to stand up to the communists, the most murderous ideology in all of human history, and win the Cold War. So nationalism is a morally neutral term, and that's what's being fought right now across the world, by the way. Brexit is a nationalist movement. What we see from our friend Geert Wilders is a nationalist movement, what we see in France and elsewhere. And, of course, Donald Trump is America first, the nation of America, patriotism. And this is something that the socialists on the left abhor. So you have, on the one hand, the pro-American president, Donald Trump, and the anti-American globalists,
who are forced more and more to double down. You know, in an article I wrote recently, which I think was originally why he gave me this call, He Fights, I point out that the left can't stand pat because they're losing. They lost the White House, they lost the Senate, they lost the House of Representatives, they lost the state legislatures, they lost the governor mansions. They're losing. So they can't stand pat. That gives them two choices. They can elevate their game. They can go high. They can really do the things that are necessary to make America succeed. But if that's the case, it's the end of the Democratic Party for two reasons. One, a successful people's don't vote Democrat. The Democrats are the party of the very, very rich, you know, Silicon Valley and Nancy Pelosi on Nob Hill in San Francisco and Hollywood megastars and the very poor. The Republicans are the party of the hardworking middle class who save prudently, invest wisely, and become wealthy and live the American dream. So a successful America is bad for the Democratic Party, which is why even when it's simply a fact that black unemployment, something that the Congressional Black Caucus should appreciate, something that the liberals should appreciate, black unemployment is at the lowest it has ever been in history under Donald Trump. This is something, how can you not applaud it? Except if you're not an American, if you're a globalist, if your own power and wealth relies on keeping minorities down and therefore sucking at the teat of government and alienated, if that is your business model, then everything that Donald Trump said is, in the eyes of the Democrats, a bad thing.
Yeah. Hey, Evan, let me ask you about something that you sort of implied, but I'd like to get you to tease it out for me a little bit. It is usually said that National Socialists are on the right. The Nazis are on the right. The fascists are on the right. What you've really just exposed, though, is to the extent that, you know, they're socialists first, that nationalism is simply being used in the service of their socialist agenda. They are actually on the left.
Yes, I call them international socialists. And really, the only difference is instead of thinking in terms of nations, they think in terms of uber nations. They think in terms of the European Union. They think in terms of one world organizations like the UN. But the policies and the mindset of socialism, look, the actual behaviors are as different as different can be. But the ideology behind the idea that the blood in your veins determines your worth as a human being is a socialist policy, whether it was Hitler who put Jews in the gas chambers because they had 132nd part blood that was Jewish, or whether you get a job at Harvard University because you have 132nd part Cherokee blood. The idea that your value, of course, or just simply lie about it, but the idea that a percentage of blood in your veins determines your worth and your value, that has remained the same, whether it's today's Democratic Party or whether it's the socialists of Nazi Germany.
But again, it's fundamentally, it's a racist concept, and the left is big on claiming that everybody else is a racist. You know, it's one of these ultimate perversions.
Oh, everything the modern liberal says is diametrically opposed to the truth. Everything. You know, whether it's that Michael Brown is a hero and that cop was a racist, whether it's Israel is committing genocide in the Middle East when in fact they're the attempted victims of it or victims of an attempt. But there is no ideological difference between the Nazis, the National Socialists who believed in a master race, and this war on white people, that if you're white, you have a life of privilege, that, you know, the idea that skin color determines, that race determines, that the amount of blood in your veins determines your worth as a human being, is a socialist concept, whether it's National Socialism or International Socialism.
And it's wrong, and it's anti-American, and those who have been exposed to be exhibiting these qualities in our own Congress should be held accountable, it seems to me. Evan Sayet, we're going to have to leave it at that for the moment. I want to commend to our listeners your superb video, A Deplorable Mind, available at Amazon Prime, as well as your terrific book, the kindergarten of Eden, how the modern liberal thinks. Kevin, I hope you will join us again soon in 2018. It is high time we have a much more regular contact and conversation with you, and I appreciate you taking the time with us today. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.